This is Wells Tech, a weekly show exploring the intersections of technology and ministry. Your hosts are Sally Draper and Martin Spriggs. Wells Tech is produced by Wells, the Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod. Hello again, everybody. This is Martin Spriggs with Wells Tech. This is episode 507, recorded on Tuesday, July 25th, 2017. A little show about technology and ministry we do each and every week, 507 of them to be more exact. Yeah, maybe that's a little fuzzy number, but close to that, and helping me in almost every one of those. And maybe I'm more helping her than she's helping me. That's Sally Draper. She's right over there in New Ulm, Minnesota. How are you?
I am great. Happy to be joining you. And no, it's not that way at all. It's that we both drag each other through and learn together. How about that?
Yep. For these many years. And if you've been following us these many years, you know that summer is a time where we kind of scale things back just a little bit. We narrow our focus and try and deliver something more or less singular in value. And this summer we decided, well, let's focus on ministry resources. Why not? That's a great thing, to kind of a gift to our listeners. I view it, you know, we spend a little bit more time and we drill a little bit deeper on a particular topic. And you and I trade off each week, and it is my turn this week. And I cheated a little bit, Sally, this week. I'm a little bit bashful to say. I spent 2 weeks ago talking about cloud services, and I made reference to other things that are kind of like cloud services, like cloud backup services. And I thought, well, maybe I ought to follow through on that and kind of give the rest of the story, so to speak. And as useful into the productivity bag of tricks that we each maintain our sync services, I think the things that I'm going to talk about today, or the things that I wrote about today, are maybe even more important, because they really have to do with the safety of your data. And I think that's something top of mind for a lot of people these days is, well, how safe really is my data? Even if it's all kind of tucked away, maybe safe and secure on my laptop or my desktop, and I'm doing all the right things, how safe really is it? So I thought I would kind of give three steps. You know, maybe they're easy, maybe they're not. I think they're fairly easy to put into your system, but I call them three easy steps to safety out there. So if you'll permit me, I think I'll just dive into step number one. And I kind of referenced it briefly 2 weeks ago, and in my intro here is, don't think of your syncing services like Google Drive or OneDrive or iCloud as a backup, because really, if one bad thing happens in one place, your syncing software is going to faithfully sync over those bad things into other places. So you really need kind of a backup tool. And I think I'm really to the point where I could recommend wholeheartedly a number of different cloud-based backup services. And the perhaps best part about these services, Sally, is that they kind of just do it by themselves. There is no intervention by you. I don't know about you, but one of the things that, you know, back in the day that prevented me from being as faithful a backupper as I should be is I had to remember it. That's not true anymore.
Well, that's good news, isn't it? And I guess they're working behind the scenes, like you said, backing up, not just syncing. So I'm guessing they're getting some of those important system files that don't normally come along when you're just syncing a directory of your work files or whatever. So
very sophisticated, like, and you have, a lot of different options. The one that I've recommended for years, and it's still, you know, number one on my list, is Backblaze. And a couple reasons that I recommend it. It's fairly inexpensive. It's really about $60 a year. And that's, if you're thinking about other solutions, backup softwares and external hard drives and whatever, it's probably a better value than that kind of approach. Not that you can't do both, but I would say that if you're looking for maybe just that last, you know, the buck stops here kind of approach, I would say Backblaze is probably that thing. The other reason I would recommend it is that it backs up everything that you want it to back up, and the cost is still the same, including any attached storage. Not all the services, backup services out there do that. All of them will back up whatever's on your hard drive, but they may not see or want to back up, let's say, an external hard drive that you've attached or a flash drive, those kinds of things. And I find that really valuable. So you could have gigabytes and terabytes of data, and the price is still going to be the same. And that's one of the reasons I like Backblaze. And like I said before, one of the things that these cloud backup services do real well is just you set them and you really forget them. You really don't have to worry about them. When you change a file, it recognizes that you've changed a file and it begins that upload process.
So, Martin, have you ever gone through the process of restoring from there when you do have to remember that you have a backup?
Is it experience too? And they've gotten better at that too. The Backblaze, what they do for maybe more manageable restores, like you're doing a directory or a file or two, is you go into their service, you check the folders or the files that you want, it zips them up, and then it sends you an email with a link to the place that you can download them. If it's a little, if you've had kind of a total system failure, let's say your hard drive has died and you need a full restore, that's probably not going to be your best route, where you're zipping up all those files and trying to send them down over the pipe. What they do, however, is they have a service where they will put it on an external hard drive, send you the drive, and they will charge you for that. I don't have to look up the price, but it's fairly reasonable, especially when you're in the state of mind that you probably are, that you just thought you lost all your data. Mm-hmm. And they'll charge you the price of the external hard drive, and you can either keep the hard drive or get that refunded to you if you send the hard drive back to them. So the cost is fairly minimal for the peace of mind that you get. I've never done that, so I can't give you any personal experiences about getting, you know, a whole drive back, but I have many times restored files or previous versions of files, which is probably more the case, where you're saying, boy, the version that I'm working with, I can't open. It's corrupted, whatever, and it's something I've worked on. It's my memoirs, it's my sermon, it's my whatever. And you don't want to, I mean, in some cases you can't rewrite it, so you want to go back in time and find a previous version, and that's what these services are great at.
Pretty sweet.
Let me go on to step two then. So pretty easy, right? Step one, pretty easy. You just buy the service, you turn it on, and away it goes. You can tell it what to back up and what not to back up if you don't want to do everything. And normally you don't need to do everything. But step number two is a little scary for some people, and that is encrypt your data. So encryption is a process where the system, usually the operating system itself, whether you're on Windows or Mac, kind of works the same way, is it inspects all your files, and using a password or a key that you set or you let it set, it goes through all the files and basically jumbles up the content so that it has to be unencrypted before it can be read by you or by anybody else. Now, the operating system makes that a pretty quick process. It only slightly slows down, you know, reads and writes. But if somebody were to come in and grab your files or your data, or, you know, ransomware were to somehow appear on your machine and they would say, hey, you're not getting this stuff back, or I've got it, you really don't have to worry too much about them being able to unencrypt it, because they don't have your password or your key if you've kept that private. And this is really easy, or has been made really easy by, like I say, the operating systems. Windows 10 is really easy. They have a system called, or a module called BitLocker. You simply need to turn that on in settings, and it will go through and you know, go through that process and encrypt everything. It takes a little while depending on how much content you have. You can also turn it on for flash drives or external hard drives. The Mac has something called File Vault. Actually, they just released fairly recently File Vault 2, which is a little bit better, faster. Works the same way. You turn it on, and it just stays on. There, you really only have to do it once. The only time you'll run into any kind of issue with these encryption technologies is if you need to do a full restore. So let's say your Windows or your Mac needs to kind of start over, and you want to do a full refresh because your data... because you want to kind of keep that data back on the machine, it may ask you for your password. And there's a couple ways to do that. You can write it down, or you can store it on another flash drive that you keep in a safe place. You just plug it in, it finds it on there, and away you go. So I would say that's a no-brainer, is to encrypt your data. You have very little performance leak, and you have just the peace of mind that, hey, you are the only one that can really get at your content if something bad were to happen. Do you ever use that, Sally?
I will be honest and say I haven't. I was just wondering if it should be something that churches and schools consider as a policy on the church
Probably.
And school computers.
Yep. We have made it a policy here in the Synod office, and you may even have it on. You may not even know it, because that's kind of our policy for especially people who deal with data. That gets stored locally. And you and I would do that with different things that we work on, databases and reports and those kinds of things. So okay. It's very important. Some people may not need this, although you probably would be surprised at the personal content and the stuff that somebody might find valuable that is on your machine. Maybe it's emails that have passwords in them, those kinds of things. Those are all things that you'd probably want to encrypt. And there's really no reason not to. So that's step number two. Step number three would not come as a surprise to you or probably to any of our longtime listeners, and that is use a password manager. All of us have lots of usernames and passwords to remember these days. Almost everything is online, which requires a username and password. And probably the worst thing that you can do for your own personal security and to keep yourself safe online is to reuse a password. I wouldn't say that 100%, because if there are services that you don't care about, just kind of throw away things or whatever, reusing a simple same password where you don't care if it gets compromised, that's fine. But there are many, many sites, banking websites, your credit card websites, church and school information systems, your church website. All those are really important to use not only different passwords, but strong passwords. And one of the barriers to doing that is, well, how am I going to remember all those? And that's where these password managers come in. And the one that we use at the Synod office for at least the technology staff is LastPass, but there are others, 1Password, and there's three or four that I could probably recommend without an issue. LastPass I like because it's cross-platform. Mac, PC, doesn't matter. There's also mobile versions, Android and iOS. It provides strong password generation. So if you go to a site and it's asking for you to set up an account, it knows that, kind of sits, it lives in your browser and says, hey, do you want me to create a strong password for you? You just click a button and you can tell it, configure it for the strength of the password. Well, it needs to have so many special characters, uppercase, lowercase, numbers, et cetera, et cetera. And then it fills it in, and not only does it fill it in, it offers to remember it for you. And then you make an entry, and you can put these in different folders, subfolders. Another thing I like about LastPass, at least in a team environment, is password sharing. So if you and I need access to a particular site, administrator writes to a website or whatever, I can share a password with you, you can share a password with me, and I really don't even need to know the password because LastPass will pre-fill it when we revisit that site. So a lot of value in a solution like LastPass, and the cost is fairly inexpensive for just the most basic version, $12 a year. I think there's even a free version, but to get the mobile version, which you probably want, $12 a year. And even an enterprise version, if you're in a group setting where you want to do password sharing and you want a little bit more control over everything, that's about $17 to $20, depends on your configuration, per person per year for nonprofits. That's what at least we paid the last time we had to renew it. I know you're a LastPass fan, Sally, because you probably couldn't do your job without it at this point, right?
You're right, Martin. I rely heavily on it for work. I also have a personal account, and you can actually kind of marry your work and your personal account, but still keep them divided up in a sense as well. So that's a nice feature. But I actually use the folder features to have to keep up with passwords, even for my mom. So not only my my work passwords, but also my mom's passwords. And so I can save those in a particular location and identify them easily and help her if she needs to get access to her bank account or something. So lots of, custom uses for the software.
So it is a scary place out there, but these are three easy steps that probably everybody should at least give some attention to or consideration to: cloud backups, data encryption, and a password manager, which is really going to help you create those hard passwords, because you probably already have had your password in the hands of somebody that you don't want it, whether you know it or not. If you are a Target customer or Home Depot or Anthem, Blue Cross, Blue Shield, I mean, the list goes on and on. And chances are that your password is out there. And if that's the same password that you use in sites that you care about, then time to change your passwords. And this just makes it easier. Any obstacle that you can remove is a good thing. In the blog post, I should mention before we close out this segment, I share a video on Google's new backup and sync solution. And this is kind of cool. This extends the capability of, let's say, Google Drive a little bit, where you can point it at different directories and it'll back it up into the cloud by device. I didn't put this on, well, I do include it on the list, although I wouldn't rate this in the same category as a Carbonite or Backblaze, for instance. It doesn't offer all the features, and it doesn't quite operate in exactly the same way as far as restoring. You don't have all the versioning that you might get, and so it's not a true backup solution, but it is certainly better, and it is a free solution, too. So that if you're interested in seeing what Google can do for you, take a look at that video. This just came out like a couple weeks ago, so it's in early days, and I'm thinking all the syncing players, like I was talking about 2 weeks ago, are going to have some kind of backup solution because they want you. They want your data in their ecosystem. So obviously that could be a concern, and I talked about that a couple weeks ago as well. But so take a look at that if you're interested, and if you're in the Google camp, that might be something just to turn on and see how it works for you.
Martin, you never cease to surprise me. I thought you were going to say you forgot to mention the introduction to your article, which dated you a little.
Well, that's a tease. So if you really want, the full plate of content, you've got to read the blog post.
But I heard a mention of a no-nonsense gruff sergeant, and I just wondered if there was one of those on this podcast, like Sergeant Phil Esterhaus from Hill Street Blues in the 80s.
You're probably too young to remember that show. That's what I'm thinking.
No, not too young, but good illustration there for sure.
Yep. Let's be safe out there. So those of you that are Hill Street fans will remember that phrase pretty well. So without further ado, why don't we step into the next segment of our little summer series, and that is, of course, our picks of the week. What do you have, Sally?
Well, I have a great article that was published recently from Church Tech Today titled 10 Things You Can't Expect from Church Volunteers. And this was a really timely article for me, Martin. I've mentioned before on the podcast that one of the things I do in my free time is volunteer with the Treasure House, which is our local thrift store that supports Minnesota Valley Lutheran High School. I know there are many of these across the Synod supporting different high schools out there. And we recently had a board, I don't know if you'd call it a retreat, a long planning session where we just did a whole lot of brainstorming and kicked around a lot of different ideas. And one of the things we really struggled with was the concept of volunteers, because even though we're running a business, and churches and schools could certainly fall into that same category, you're running a business per se, you're relying heavily on volunteers to make that happen. They are our, you know, tried and true army workforce, and we couldn't do it without them in all those different settings. And so, and we heard these very things that are mentioned in this article, our expectations of them. If we expect too little, they don't see their contribution as important. If we expect too much, we risk losing them. You know, we want them to know they're doing something important and that they're valued and respected, but yet we want to respect their time and the fact that they're just volunteers, not paid workers and things. So 10 things you can't expect. You can't expect them to invest time without understanding the goals. And number two, to accomplish any task without understanding the why of the request. Those two kind of go together. You want them to buy in, to see your vision, to know how they fit into the puzzle of things happening in your church or school or thrift store setting, whatever it may be. Articulate a vision that they aren't seeing modeled. So if you're saying one thing, but you're actually doing another, they're not going to be real willing to pitch in and do it the right way unless you're living it as well. You shouldn't expect volunteers to function without encouragement or work for free. Even though your organization isn't paying them, you certainly can verbally encourage them, pass along feedback from other people that you receive, and you can always buy them donuts if nothing else. You know,
I thought you were going to say chocolate, but...
Yeah, exactly. You're not paying them, but maybe you could budget $20 a week toward showing your appreciation to them. You can't expect volunteers to have your back if you don't have theirs. So, you know, you got to be willing to publicly defend and privately handle important issues without putting them in an awkward position. And then a couple of these at the end really kind of spoke to me. You can't expect volunteers to produce last-minute miracles on a consistent basis. We've all been there where it's crunch time and we've got to scramble. VBS starts in 3 hours and we're trying to pull together the last crafts or whatever it may be. And some people can do that, but they can't do it over and over and over again. Like number 8 says, you can't expect them to drop everything because you failed to plan ahead. You know, they can't fill in those gaps every single time if it comes down to a crunch time or whatever. I really like number 9 on the list, be creative without direction, support, and preparation. For me, creativity is not something I can just flip on and off. And that's exactly what they say in the blog post. It takes some energy and some thought, and you can't just expect them to come up with these miraculous creative ideas or whatever without nurturing that in your volunteer force. And then you really can't expect to motivate them long-term using guilt. So we can't just, you know, guilt them into working for us and doing a good job. So I think those were some really great reminders. Like I said, fits perfectly with the discussion we had about motivating volunteers for the Treasure House. And I'm sure it fits well in your church and school settings as well.
Very nice. That's really good stuff, and I think there is a lot of value in really kind of considering your volunteer program as just that, a volunteer program where you're taking the time to strategize and think about training your leadership to understand that, so it's not just an expectation, you know, that just happens. Really running a volunteer program, which is what all of, you know, a lot of our churches and schools are all about. It's part, there's an important part of ministry, so you need to treat it as such. So
definitely.
Very good. Thank you, Sally. Good blog post. My pick of the week is a new photo service that I took advantage of the other day called Google Photo Books. And it is fairly new. It is a service that works a lot like some of the other ones that you've seen where you upload pictures. Google is actually kind of smart about it, and you'd think that they would be because they're, you know, their artificial intelligence and their search capabilities put together make for some, if you've ever used Google Photos, you know that it's almost uncanny how they do stuff for you, collect photos and enhance different things and put collages together. They have really applied the same thing to this photo books where you actually can print your pictures. And I think that's maybe one thing that we've lost with this digital age is a lot of people don't print their photos anymore. So they just are kind of held hostage, you know, in our phones or iPads or computers, and they don't get the visibility maybe that would bring some enjoyment. And so I decided to take advantage of this, and the price is actually pretty reasonable for a, I believe it's a 6x6 soft cover. It's like $10. And I actually went for the 9x9 hardcover option, which gives you 20 pages of photos. Oh, it's a 7-inch square on the soft cover, and they're both 20 pages. And then 35 cents or 65 cents, respectively, for additional pages. So we recently were given by our kids a 30th wedding anniversary gift of a professional photo shoot. Now that was last year. We finally got everybody together to do this. The family was all together because of my daughter Yana's wedding. So the Saturday before, we all went out to the park, had a professional photographer come out and take our pictures, and we got them back. And 5 days later, I had a book that we used or that I put together. Man, there's not a lot of options, I would say, that you have. And it's really nice. The only branding is on the very back where it says Google Photos. Everything else you have control over. You can put some text in. I just did all pictures, and you have three formats you can pick from. You can have this full page with a white border around it as a potential one, or you can do full page. So there's my oldest grandson, Murray, and my youngest, the only other grandson, Arlo. And then you can do, I love the one, the wagon. I'm just showing off my grandkids at this point, but they, you've got three different routes you can go. So you can do a little bit more full size, the dimensional picture, and fill every page. You can put text on it if you want, but it's a nice glossy matte page. I would say this is more a coffee table book where you would just put it, you know, just put it out, and maybe you even have, I'm thinking maybe I'll do this on a number of occasions, and then you'll have just kind of a shelf full of these kind of photo albums that are really nice just to open up and kind of reminisce or share with people or whatever. These would make, I think, great gifts as well for $20 plus shipping. So I think altogether it was like $25 and took about 5 days. I uploaded the photos, and Google takes its best shot at kind of rearranging and picking photos. So you can say, point it at a particular photo library and it'll say, well, I like this one. But you can pull those in and out and rearrange and whatever. It's all drag and drop, and it's actually fairly easy. So they've kind of taken the complicated nature of some of these layouts, and I've tried some of these before where you got to kind of resize and layout and, you know, collage and whatever. It's just really, it took me about 10 minutes to put this together, hit the buy it button, and then 5 days later I had it. So really impressed with this. Apple does the same kind of thing, about the same price, but the quality's good. The experience was excellent, and now we have a remembrance of that. Plus, you know, we still have the digital photos, of course, too. But this just makes it a little bit easier to share and something that, you know, reminds us of that that neat time. So I can think you could do it at for vacation photos, weddings, you know, all kinds of things that you could do that in a little bit more permanent way. So that is Google Photo Books. So you have to use Google Photos, of course, to get it. But once your photos are in there, then you can hit the button and away it goes.
Nice pick, Martin. I've seen a lot more of these kind of tools out there, but I really like the fact that you get the power of Google. You could search on someone's name or something and come up with pictures
right.
from across your photo library.
Right, some of the tools that are available there, right?
Yeah, very nice. I'm curious if you got any pushback from them about using the professional photographer's photos.
None. Well, we have a release from the photographer. We didn't have to use it.
Okay.
So, and none of these were watermarked or anything either. I don't know if that would have, you know, raised a red flag or whatever. Mm-hmm. Our photographer was a family friend. So we didn't have the, you know, Olin Mills or, you know, whatever the, you know, the professional photographer would put on there. So I don't know if, and I didn't read it. I think you have to sign a release. As I remember the process, there's a box that you check, and that, I think that's the only part that would even reference that. So,
Interesting. I know I've gotten pushback from getting 1 hour photos developed.
Oh, I did have that at Walgreens too. Pictures that I took. I took the same pictures for my youngest daughter. And even though I didn't have them watermarked or anything, they said, well, these look like professional, which was a great compliment that, they're calling my photos professional, but they would not print them. But I went down to the Walmart or the Walgreens in the next town and they did it. So wasn't real tight, but I know what you're saying. Yeah.
Well, good to know.
Yep. All right. Let's move on to a little bit of community feedback we have this week.
And these are all just fun things, I think. Well, at least the first one. It actually kind of ties into the discussion about passwords and security and things, because it's a fun little article that Pastor Missionary Guy Marquardt shared. It's called What It Feels Like Sometimes. And the guy took the example of making a ham and cheese sandwich and squeezing a little hot mustard on it. And he says, the bottle beeps and flashes a numerical code on the label. I take my phone out of my pocket and Google the error code, and it says bottle cannot dispense mustard until it connects to Gluten's server. I have no idea why it needs to connect to the internet to perform such a simple non-internet needing task, but whatever. I check the Wi-Fi's down, I fix the Wi-Fi, mustard bottles still won't dispense, online troubleshooting suggests I perform a soft reset. I hold down the cap for 5 seconds until the mustard bottle reboots. Now it needs me to re-authenticate. I set up this mustard bottle ages ago, so I don't remember the password. I fetch it from 1Pass. Bottle authenticates successfully, but it notes that my password hasn't been changed in a long time, and for the safety of my mustard, the bottle won't allow me to proceed until I create a new one. And it goes on from there. So if you're looking for a fun read and perhaps a look at our future, our to commiserate about our current state of affairs, this is a pretty good article.
1 hour later, you have your mustard. Yeah.
Well, yeah, he runs into a few more problems. He has to change his password again, which he forgets what he just changed it to. So he has trouble in that regard. And I'm like, yeah, I can so relate to this. And so
happens more than one would think. Yeah. I was talking to Debbie, my wife, the other day, and I probably shouldn't share the story, but this is probably pretty common, is that there are some sites where she is just totally reliant on the forgot password feature. Mm-hmm. She doesn't write it down. She may remember it if it's one of her, you know, and I've had these conversations, but that forgot password, if the site doesn't have it, then what good is it?
Right.
That is her password system. So,
yeah.
So I have a little work to do there, but normally she picks fairly strong passwords. And we were out, we took a overnight trip up to, where did we go? Up near Algoma, Kewaunee area, if anybody from Wisconsin knows where those are. We just did an overnight up there and it went to a couple wineries or whatever. She took her iPad and could not remember because the password, the iPad had to reboot with an update. And, you know, you can't use your ID, your fingerprint ID, with when it restarts, when it does a physical restart. And for the whole trip, she could not remember the iPad password that she had set. And it would tell her, every time you guess, you have three chances, I think. And then on the fourth one, it says, you can't try again for 15 minutes. And then it gets progressively longer. So you can't try again for an hour, or you can't try again for 3 hours. So needless to say, she didn't use her iPad. We got home and she looked it up on where she stores her passwords. And I thought that was just hilarious. She wasn't that amused by it, but that's pretty funny. Because there is no forgot, you know, send me my forgotten password on your iPad login screen. So.
Sure. Well, I'm thinking that she just needed to be unplugged that weekend.
That's God's little message to her. Yeah. Yes. We had a great time anyway. So
very good. Very good. All right. One more in the community feedback area. And although this one actually came from me, I saw a cool little infographic just screaming to be pinned on our Pinterest page. It was a social media cheat sheet for small businesses and bloggers. And it actually, the thing I liked about it was it talks about Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Pinterest, and how many times per day you should be posting things to these sites and what the best times are, and then some tools to use to do that. And Martin, in case you aren't up on it, we should be posting 10 times per day.
Why in the world is Pinterest 10 times more than what?
Why would it not
Twitter.
Be?
No, it's not Twitter. Facebook, right?
Yeah, then Facebook. Twitter was like 5 times a day. Instagram and Facebook 1 or 2 times a day. But yeah, why not? Pinterest is a happening place.
I do not get it.
So.
What could you possibly pin for 10 times a day? How many of those could you
They help you with that on this infographic as well. They say what to post, from quotes, tips, behind-the-scene photos, your product photos, questions, polls, good content from others, offers, discounts, interesting facts, fill-in-the-blanks, videos, funny snippets from your life. Do you have any funny snippets?
Pinterest is so high because you have different boards and different subscribers to those boards. So you're not just bombarding the same people with the same stuff.
And, you know, that good content from others comes into play there a lot more probably than in the others, where you're actually just pinning
it's
things you've
focused,
found
right.
that subject or whatever.
Yep, that makes sense. I'll cut it a little slack there.
Woo. So anyway, check out the infographic on the Pinterest board over at Wells Tech.
Okay. Little something special in our featured video segment.
This is true, Martin. I'm excited to share a video which was recently produced by our friends at Final Web. Now, I haven't heard an official announcement regarding the release of Final Web 2.0, but if you want to get a peek at what it's going to be like, they recorded a video just showing some of the behind-the-scenes editing and interface that you're going to be dealing with and how the sites look and things. So the brand new Final Web video is available, and we'll include that on our website.
Yep, and you'll note, and I've been working a little bit with the beta. I haven't had a lot of time to play with it, but and I think they're thinking this is going to be launched very, very soon. Is a lot more graphical, a lot more mobile friendly. Kind of the big image, responsive, you know, things that you'll see in a modern website, they've tried to make as easy as possible. And very excited to kind of take that next step for Final Web. I know a lot of our listeners probably use Final Web, so this has got to be good news for all of them.
Yeah, definitely.
Next week, Sally, you're going to be jumping in the car and coming over to Watertown, Wisconsin to join me at the, 64th Biennial Synod Convention. We're convening in Watertown, Wisconsin, and you'll be there helping out with stuff, and I'll be there, And we're going to do a show like we normally do on Tuesday afternoon, get it up probably on Wednesday if all goes well. And got some interesting interviews, some delegates, a seminary professor, and a CMM coworker. So lots of good stuff, talking about convention and things going on at convention and how technology maybe plays a part there too. So tune in next week for our Synod, our special Synod Convention podcast number 508.
Looking forward to it.
All right. Safe travels, Sally. Thanks all of you for joining us once again. Again, don't forget about our show notes page. That's where all this stuff lives. If you heard us talk about something, you want to find the link to it or didn't quite catch where it was and what we were referring to, that all shows up on the show notes page thanks to the gifts and dedication of Sally Draper. That's wellstech.wells.net. Also, if you want to contribute to our community feedback section or even a suggestion for future shows, that's the place to do it. Get on one of those social networks that we're a part of. Send us an email, wellstech@wells.net. Lots of ways to join the conversation. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.